Welcome to The Scrub Life, a podcast for and about the incredible profession of surgical technology. I'm Chris Blevins, and our mission at The Scrub Life is to educate the public about surgical technology. Each episode dives into the wonderful world of surgery, where we inform and hopefully entertain our listeners while interviewing amazing individuals within the field and presenting the hot topics everyone wants to know more about. We've now partnered with the Association of Surgical Technologists to help us expand our conversations, bolster our engagement, and bring further awareness to the surgical technology profession. CSTs are an integral part of the sterile team that cares for patients in the operating room. Learn more about this exciting field, the immense effort that goes into educating future CSTs, and how you too can become a ninja of the OR. Now, without further ado, here's the latest episode of the Scrub Life Podcast. Thank you, everybody, for joining us for another episode. I really am excited about my guest today. He's a dear friend of mine, but he's also just an incredible rock star, both in the classroom and the operating room. So let's get started. I'd like to introduce to you all John Hadley. Hello, Mr. Hadley.
Hello, Chris. Thank you for the invite, and I appreciate the warmth of that. That was a little more than I usually get.
You can pay me later. It'll be fun.
Sure.
So, for those people who may not have had the pleasure of meeting you, I want you to start out by telling them who you are and what you're doing currently in your position.
Currently, I am the program director at the Des Moines Area Community College Surgical Technology Program, which is based in Urban Des Moines.
Urban Des Moines in Iowa.
Correct, in Iowa.
Absolutely. How long have you been in education?
And I've been in education for, this will be my eighth year, I believe, that I'm starting right now.
Me too. So, yeah. We got stuck in this at the same time, friend.
Well, that's how I met you, actually. And I don't know if I was supposed to bring that up, but as instructors, we have to play defense a lot. And defense means you got to find ways to do things better. And that's exactly how I met you, Chris, and many others that have helped me along the way.
It definitely takes a village. And I think that something that most people would be shocked to know is that I think we can be super territorial in the operating room, right? Like, this is my surgeon, this is my specialty, you know, these are my cases. But when you get into the education portion of it, it's the exact opposite. Like, there is an entirely different support system. And we can put it out there and say, hey, like, I'm having this issue and I need help. And next thing you know, you've got tons of people that are offering any help that they can get. And that was a pleasant surprise to me. I don't know if you had the same kind of observation.
Absolutely. I get contacts continuously from other program directors and other faculty instructors that ask me, you know, hey, I'm a new program director and I heard you speaking at the last conference and things like that. And it's so nice to have all that help. It's everywhere. It's here in the Scrub Life. It's in social media. It's at your conferences, your workshops. It's all there. So yeah, you just really have to go grab it.
Today, I really wanted to talk to you about your experiences before you came over to the dark side in education, because you've had just a really awesome career in the operating room. And so before we kind of delve into that, how did you even get started in surgery to begin with? I always love hearing people's origin stories.
So mine is a little strange, because I came out of high school and was doing some odds and ends construction work on the side, cooking at a restaurant. But I landed a job in the laundry at the biggest hospital at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And quickly realized that job wasn't going to be something I wanted to do for a long time, because it was physically exhausting.
You didn't want to fold sheets for the rest of your life?
It was loading washers and dryers 600 pounds at a time. And you got about 5 minutes to get to the next one. And they're 120 degrees. You know, they're not cold and stuff.
Yeah. So,
and it wears you out. I just was not that fun. But I met a few guys from Central Service because they would, I'd deliver laundry carts sometimes to them. And I met these two gentlemen down there. And one of them was telling me, he goes, "Hey man, I'm going to school to be a surgical tech. And the Mayo Clinic will pay for your school if you just go." And I'm like, "Say what?" I go, "I don't know, surgery, you know, it's blood and guts." And he's like, "Yeah, well," he goes, "it's a 1-year program and you're in the OR working." And I'm like, "Whoa, that does sound kind of cool." I didn't think about it too much, worked for a while. And then my friend Ron got a job working in surgery. And he says, "You know, you really should think about this. You can't be working in that laundry forever. That's just going to wear you right out." Yeah. And Ron was a big bodybuilder guy who I had a lot of respect for, became good friends with him, you know, just from meeting him at work. And he says, "Come job shadow, see what you like, see if you like it." And I'm like, "Yeah, okay, I think I will." And I went up there and I was like, "Whoa, this is cool." Like, yeah. And it's intense. Like, and look at him, like he's right in, he's scrubbing in and everything, you know, because when you don't know what a surgical tech is, you don't know.
Right.
And I thought, wow, that's a 1-year program. I'm checking into this. Checked into it, shot through it. They hired our entire group before we actually graduated because they had a lot of operating rooms. You know, they had just built at that time a 65 OR suite at the hospital I was doing laundry at.
Oh, my
God. There were plenty of jobs there. And there was another hospital that had almost as many downtown as well. So they, at that time, had quite a few operating rooms, and they wanted CSTs to scrub in all of their operating rooms. Some of the, at that time, there were still some nurses scrubbing, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the goal was to get the CSTs to scrub the cases. And I took a job in cardiac surgery, and I didn't want to. Actually, I wanted to go to ortho. I was like, "Yeah, I want to do some drills and saws, and this is me."
And all the guys want to go into ortho, right? Yeah. Hammer things, break stuff. Yeah.
And they told me, "No, you're going to cardiac. You can switch in a few years if you think you really want to switch into something else." And I thought, well, I got a job, I might as well do it. And I loved it. I just loved it. Oh, it was the best. I just, the intensity. At first it was shock and awe because you're so scared. You're like, "I don't know if I can do this. Like, I have to put the bypass tubing together. Are you kidding me? Don't they have perfusionists here?" And back then we did it all, and we had these baskets with connectors, and we just put it all together for.
I kind of just want to pause here because that experience is the whole reason why we are talking today, because you were a heart scrub at the Mayo Clinic, which is such a really cool experience, whether you wanted it or not. Defined who you became. And so what was it that finally drew you to say, "Yeah, cardiovascular is my jam. Like, screw ortho. This is what I want to do."
I think I didn't realize it at the time, but I think honestly, it was the unlimited growth was just laying there in front of me. And I thought, "Man, this is just so much." I mean, we had 10 cardiac surgeons. It was just a very busy place. And vascular and thoracic was a combined section when I started. They broke off after a while, but so we had to learn all that too. And I did vascular and thoracic surgery for several years. The cardiac side though, was the fun and the growth side of it, and the challenging side to get through those large cases. And you know how it is when you're first starting, you want to be the person that they don't have to ask for anything from. Mm-hmm. That's the goal, right?
Right.
That's the goal. I want to be the guy that I'm ready. Stick your hand out. Here it comes, you know, pow. And in cardiac, that just takes a while. It really does. The cases are large. And
I think that surgeries. Having patience is something I have to struggle with telling my students all the time, right? When you graduate from school, that's just the beginning of your journey. Like, it's going to take you a long time to become the actual expert in the room, which is what we all want to be.
Right.
So in cardiovascular, like, how long do you think it took you to finally feel, I don't know, comfortable is the word, because I don't think we ever truly, like, if you're really comfortable, that's when bad things happen.
Right. Well, and part of your goal is to learn all that, but to get comfortable is often past that, what you would call your orientation phase, because you have to be able to, and we've talked about this before, but you have to be able to wing it. And there's not always going to be that straightforward case coming at you. And dang it, if it doesn't always happen when no one's around. Yeah. So you're gonna be responsible to have your skills at least at a level where you can get through that successfully and feel good about what you did. Yeah. And I think that takes investment in yourself, mm-hmm. you know, and trying to be the best at your job that you can be. And you can do that. It's a lot of it's about attitude and wanting to learn and develop your skills to that point, because yeah. you're gonna have other people rely on you. And you quickly realize that when a whole horde of new employees are coming in right behind you and you're like, holy smokes, they sure go through them around here. And sometimes you think that, but part of it is the growth of the place was just astronomical when I started. So they were always needing people.
So who do you think that you learned from when it came to the types of cases that you were doing? I would imagine, I know, like I did cardiovascular. So I know that you had an incredible relationship with the perfusionist, as you mentioned, but also like the lab tech that would come in and run your blood gases constantly. The team, I worked at a teaching hospital, so residents and chiefs, and God bless them, those lovely med students, you know. And then you're also your other scrubs and your RN, like it's a beautiful dance when it all comes together well. I guess, where do you find that you learned the most from when it came to CB at Mayo?
I would say probably a combination of my preceptors and the residents and fellows that you mentioned. The consultants are the staff guys. They're often called attendings in a lot of places. We call mm-hmm. them consultants at Mayo, but they tend to just come in for the pump runs and they're not really in for the whole case. And they're not really wanting to be bothered about explaining the case to you. Right. So they kind of expect you to know what the case is by the time you're doing one. So the fellows and residents are really, really good. And we had a lot of foreign fellows and residents, which was a huge advantage uh-huh. because they wanted to learn English and wonder what did Dr. Puga say to me that one time? And I'm like, oh my God, you don't even know.
And you don't want to know something.
Yeah. And they're like, teach me some English. I'm like, okay, teach me some Japanese. And so we'd trade off. And then in between there, explain this, what we're doing, because I was doing a lot of congenital stuff with a pediatric surgeon.
Yeah.
And those cases were all creative construction is what I would call it. And I worked with a genius of a surgeon who didn't have very good social skills in the operating room. That's funny enough, by the way. They yeah. kept a book in the non-sterile cupboard of all the sayings that he would say. And I named my dog after him, unfortunately, for my dog. But it was just an homage to him, because even though I had to put up with, you know, not always being treated properly, mm-hmm. but the expectations were so high, it made me a far better scrubber. And I can tell you that working with people on those levels is going to ramp up your skills. You're going to have to. If I even looked away, Dr. Puga would know. And he would stop and he'd probably chew me out for not paying attention because I looked away for a minute.
Yeah.
And that's the intensity that he had. So, and he said bad things. He called me she sometimes. She doesn't know. She's guessing again. You know, these kind of things. And I'm like, oh my God. And we had a book of all the sayings. It was brutal sometimes.
Yeah.
But fun to look back on. You have to have some humor or it's not. You're not going to get through it.
No, you're not. I think that, you know, we scrubs can have a very morbid sense of humor, but that's how we bond, really. And it's how you deal with the stress, because you can't take a time out and be like, I need 5 minutes to breathe and, you know, control my emotions. You don't have that. That's called patient abandonment.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get in trouble for that kind of stuff. Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to pick your brain about is that you had the opportunity to create the heart transplant team out at Mayo and be a part of those early days. Talk to me about that.
So that all started a few years after I started working at Mayo. Mm-hmm. And it was a big process, but at that time we only had a small group of transplant surgeons. As Mayo went on and they hired more cardiac surgeons, most of them had to be transplant savvy so they could take turns being on call, you know.
Exhausting.
Guys on call. But it was fun. I mean, we built an operating room with a laminar flow system that blew from the ceiling down, so it froze you all during the case, which wasn't always fun to scrub. You know, you'd sometimes keep a warm bucket of saline just to dunk your hands in, because when your hands are wet and that thing's blowing on them for the whole case, they just go numb.
Yeah, they're ice. And then if you have to retract or hold the heart, like, woo, you can't move and you can't feel.
It gets tough. And having said that, I would say that transplant cases overall are not overly challenging as far as the technical skill you need to get through it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, just like any specialty in surgery, it's going to have its wicked moments. Uh-huh. And those are the ones you've put VADs in people that you now have to take out to change them out, things like that. The real complex stuff that you can't predict some of the things that happen in those right. situations. And it's a nightmare. But
so tell me about one of those.
So one that I can remember is we had put a VAD in a gentleman who had a disease process that was attacking his liver and heart.
Well, and let's tell people what a VAD is. So ventricular assistive device.
Yeah. Right? So
we understand that.
And now this ventricular assist device goes way back to where they were large and had a console and this kind of stuff. It wasn't like the nice, neat little things we implant in people today that can run around and go back to farming and whatever.
Yeah.
These people were pretty much, they were going to stay in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So, but this guy, he was so emaciated from his amyloidosis that, and he was deteriorating, and putting the VAD in was supposed to tune him up, right? And
right.
His organs functioning, they're getting perfusion again and start tuning the organs up. But in the process of getting his donor heart and bringing him to the OR, trying to get that VAD out was a huge bleeding mess, which we ended up doing open heart massage on him for about 45 minutes before we actually could get him on bypass and then get the heart in and the liver and all that. So it was a huge, that was, I believe was almost an 18 hour case that I scrubbed. And that's uncommon. Mm-hmm. Thank God, because those things are going to make you go home. And then you go, why am I here?
What am I doing this for?
Yeah, because then you start asking yourself those questions. You're like, what am I doing this? I mean, seriously, this is a lot of stress and intensity to be going through. And then, you know, you think, yeah, but we got through it and we got that guy implanted and I played basketball against him a while later at the YMCA, which was shocking to me. It was absolutely shocking to me to see that guy walk out on the basketball court and make that connection again. And it was just weird.
And I think that's really cool because we don't usually get to have that closure.
Right.
Get a patient off the table. I have a similar story to liver transplants. And I remember being on, I'd worked 410s, but I was on call. I had pagers back in the day, John. Like that's yeah, what we're talking yeah. about, right? I got to my car in the parking lot. My pager went off after a 10-hour. Walk right back in. And this guy, our liver transplant ended up being 14 hours because we could not, his artery was just falling apart during the anastomosis. So we just couldn't get this guy. We had to put him on bypass, which isn't always the case for livers, but I was dead. Like I was literally dead. I didn't even go home. I just slept on a stretcher because there was no way I could have gotten in the car. And I do. I remember doubting every decision I had ever made in my life after that. But I remember probably a couple weeks later, I'm walking down the hallway to the cafeteria and I see this guy in a wheelchair and PCT or whoever was wheeling him. And I realized like that's the patient and his jaundice had gone away. He looked like a completely different person. And I'm holding my lunch, you know, my styrofoam container. And I'm just staring at this dude in the hallway, like in shock. And he's looking at me like, who is this crazy chick staring at me? Cause he didn't, you know, they don't know who you are. And I couldn't say anything. I'm not going to be like, my hands were literally up in your abdomen for 12 hours, but you can't say that. But I just, that was something I think that I needed to stop doubting the journey that I was on, you know?
You get those little, and it, You know, as a CST, that's hard. It's hard to find that in your life. You're that person behind the scenes that's always doing the right thing and a part of the direct healthcare team, but you don't get to see the result a lot. And my wife was a cardiac ICU nurse for years. So that was pretty fun because I wanted to have lunch with her, right?
Yeah.
So I go up to the cardiac ICU and see who she's taking care of. I'm like, yes, we did that guy 2 days ago. So then I go and knock and she's like, hey, you want to, she'll ask the patient, do you want to meet the guy that scrubbed your case? And he's like, yeah, that'd be really cool. And then I'd go in there and she'd say, this is John. He works with Dr. Schaff. And this particular guy we did a myectomy on, and he was used to be a professional skater. So he tells me, he goes, I feel 2 days later, I feel 100% better. He goes, I'm about to go put some skates on and go skating. And I'm like,
oh God,
wow. We just split your chest and did a huge cardiac operation on you, but you're ready to go skating. That's cool.
Oh,
and that was a little bit of a shocker to me because I thought that was a day and a half ago, really. And
yeah.
This guy feels great. He's sitting up in bed. He's extubated. He's ready to get out of the ICU and go skating, you know?
What do you think the surgery that you did the most, like what was the procedure I think that was most common at Mayo?
You know, it's that kind of goes by for us in within specialties, there's subspecialties. So that is very dependent on the surgeons you're working with.
Yeah.
So for quite a while I did peds. I worked with an adult guy for quite a while who was very quick. And we did a lot of bread and butter cardiac surgery, aortic valves, aneurysms, mitral valves. He was a mitral valve specialist and he would crank through those like crazy. So we did a lot of that. We did a lot of myectomies. And on the peds side, one of the fellows that came through ended up becoming the chief of cardiac surgery and is currently the chief there right now. So I was there through his training and stuff. And that was really fun to, it's another guy you learn a ton from. Because they're in their training, they're happy to explain stuff to you. And when you're doing these complex pediatric cases where the heart just becomes this pump and everything else you're rerouting to make that pump be able to get you systemic blood, you know, it becomes very confusing sometimes what you're doing to some of these kids. And you'd learn a lot after the case. I'd say, okay, explain to me where that conduit went where, because the anatomy is so messed up, you can't tell what the pulmonary arteries are and what's going on. So he'd explain stuff to you.
I think also, you know, I learned a lot from talking to Tim, who does pediatric cases. And, you know, his one big thing was that pediatrics is not just operating on little humans. It's not the same as operating on adults. Did you find that to be true, even specifically to the cardiac surgeries?
Absolutely. And I think that's kind of one of the big things about Mayo, is not just for cardiac surgery where I work, but you could take neurosurgery, for instance, and you're going to find a group of neurosurgeons that are going to subspecialize. Some are going to do craniotomies and they're going to be really good at craniotomies. And they're going to tailor those cases to their patients.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much what they all do. And I didn't work with someone that did a lot of coronary surgery. I certainly did my share of it, working with the other surgeons and that kind of thing. Some of that, like I said, you get from working with a particular surgeon. I worked with a guy who did root replacements for quite a while, and he no longer works at Mayo, but that was his specialty. And I even had the argument with him. I said, these patients come here for you. We never did this many root replacements until you showed up. He's like, no, that's just Mayo. They see the name Mayo and they come running. And I'm like, no. As soon as he left, there wasn't a whole lot of root replacements going on. There wasn't three a day or four a day like when he was there.
So what to you was the biggest difference when you did pediatric surgery?
It's
just the congenital stuff where you were basically rerouting a pump?
Well, there's a whole lot that leads up to that too, because you can shunt arteries to grow them so that you can do complete repairs later, things like that. So there was you learn a lot of those steps of patients. Some patients just can't get a complete repair until they grow their lungs enough to be able to handle that blood flow to them. So that was where our surgeons were just masterful. They created procedures for that and got very well known. They had people always standing, watching, trying to learn from them. shoot, we had an anesthesiologist. She would stand on top of the anesthesia machine and be looking. Oh, and it was creepy sometimes because you're like, can you get away from the top of the lights?
It's like the face of God, like hovering over.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, but that was, he was just that skilled that people wanted to learn from him. And he, like I said, he wasn't the guy that's going to explain it to you. In fact, he's gonna pretty much beat up everyone in the room on the way through it. Doesn't feel bad about it. We even had these meetings in the morning because of him and his crazy attitude and stuff. And he called them sensitivity meetings. Why do we have these sense? He just turned them into beating meetings, and we had to stop doing them because he was supposed to be explaining some of the crazy stuff that he does to us, and he just wanted to thrash us for a little bit longer. So we stopped having them. It was funny, but
so
we learned a lot from each other.
Yeah, Mayo is definitely known, I think, for their experimental kind of like leading edge surgeries in all sorts of specialties. When I say that, like, what kind of procedure comes to mind, or what experience came to mind for you in your experience?
I think, you know, that's, again, that starts to fall into subspecialties of things. But I do think Mayo, you know, they are known for progressing a lot of those initiatives. But I do think they're cautious about starting things. I mean, we were really cautious about the VAD program and that kind of thing, because patient selection is a huge factor in all of that.
Yeah.
And you start twisting into the edges of all of that, you can start to have bad outcomes, and then that's going to chase you. So they're a little more cautious, especially about the products they use, that kind of thing. But I think sometimes they sit back a little bit and see how maybe Cleveland's doing, and you know, and then they jump in. And, you know, robots was an example. Everybody went robot crazy. And in cardiac surgery, Mayo kind of laid back for a while and let the learning curve develop. But then once they did go in, they went mitral valve crazy in there, and they were doing 300 robotic mitrals a year, you know.
How was that training for you? Were you resistant to learning, or were you like, go for it?
You know, I was already kind of heading towards, I was finishing nursing school, and I was already kind of wiggling my way away from that. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have a deep experience in it, other than I watched it go from where we could do a robotic mitral valve in about 12 hours when we first started doing them. Okay. And got them down to basically what it takes to do an open one.
Yeah.
A little bit longer maybe, but, and you know, when those surgeons, the problem at Mayo is everybody wants that name attached to their resume. Mm-hmm. So then the surgeons come and go, you know, Mayo doesn't hire surgeons under contract. They hire a surgeon, and then if they don't need you anymore, you can find some work elsewhere. So, and they go through surgeons a little more often than when I first started, and they were contracting surgeons. They now shoot through them pretty regularly. Once they get that Mayo name and they've done a few thousand robotic mitrals, they can pretty much go anywhere.
And they do.
Right. So they scatter around the country, and they're in some big places too. But
one of the things that you and I have talked about, and I thought it was really interesting, was you were a part of kind of a study on the humanism in the operating room, right?
Yes.
And how that's a factor in the outcome for all sorts of procedures. Talk to me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and that was, so I worked with an aortic surgeon for a while, who, he was the one that specialized in root replacements, and he would spare your aortic valve so that everybody wanted him to fix it because you get to keep your aortic valve.
Right, which is a good day.
Yeah. And he'd resuspend it into a HemoShield graft and create a new root for you. Mm-mm. But it was pretty crafty. He was very skilled at it. But one of the things he wanted to do, he was big on human factors, and he wanted to understand the communication breakdown. And some of this actually happened live with me and him. I can remember a case where we were doing an aortic valve replacement, and he wanted to use a mechanical valve. And I had read in his note prior to the case that the patient wanted a biological valve. And so we get to the point where we're going to size the valve, and he says, give me this St. Jude sizers. I'm like, what? Whoa, no. Your note says biological. I have CE sizers, which is the biological size.
Right.
He's like, no, God.
Bless it.
Give me the St. Jude sizers and stop arguing with me. Geez, we're cross-clamped. And I'm like, all right. So I asked the circulator, but we used to print the notes too. She brought it over and I said, why don't you look at the note quick and just, and he leans over and looks at it and he goes, by God, give me the CE sizer. And he puts it in there and we put a CE valve in. After the case, he didn't say a lot. After the case, he said to me, he goes, thank you very much for speaking up because I was going to put a mechanical valve in that guy and he would have been anticoagulated for the rest of his life and all this stuff. And he was an attorney and thank you. Thank you. And I'm like, you're welcome. And
it would have been
we became pretty good friends that day.
Well, tell me you use that when you talk to your students. You know, we talk to them about see something, say something, and advocate for your patient, surgical conscience. You know, we like ream and drill this into them. And I think telling them live, real instances, it's got to help drive it home.
Absolutely. And I mean, accountability is such a big thing in the operating room, and you have to be personally accountable. That's your job, to have that surgical conscience. And really be accountable to what you're doing. If you're just going to stand there and watch things go by, that's not doing your job.
You need to get the hell out of our profession.
Yeah, that's not giving the patient your best effort, which is what you should always do. I mean, mom's on the table. Let's give her the best thing, right?
Yeah. I think that part of what we also discussed was that the Mayo taught you so many things, right? But also it kind of ruined your patience there for a little. And I don't mean patience is in the person on the table. I mean, like our ability to tolerate a learning curve.
For sure. And I think that's probably one of the most challenging in a highly acute, intense environment like cardiac surgery can be. That's one of the hardest things is to try to maintain some sense of patience, because you're going to get Lulu circulating for you. She's never been in the core, doesn't know where anything is. And you're doing a case that shouldn't have Lulu circulating. It's just, your patients will be torched. And I know Kevin Craycraft will talk a little bit about patients too. We have similar backgrounds, but cardiac surgery is not good for that.
No,
it's really not. And I had to break away from that becoming an instructor, because the patients for students has to be there. You have to be there. And just like in the operating room, you're going to meet every type of personality you can imagine. Mm-hmm. That when you study how to communicate, like we did with Dr. Sunt in the human factor studies, you understand a lot better. Whoa, that's your perception of that was way different than mine.
Yeah.
And you start to learn that I have to communicate better. If that's how you understood me. I mean, I can remember Dr. Sunt telling me, did you hear what you just said to me? Like, they would show back some of the footage and stuff. And I'm like, well, I don't remember saying that. He goes, you called me a dick. And I'm like, I did? He's like, yes. I'm like, man, I'm sorry. I go, well, I didn't mean to. You don't realize the things continuously listening to you and filming you and that kind of thing. Right. We had it in the liver transplant room too.
Uh-huh.
And that was challenging because the guy that ran the program sat up in the library and he'd jump on the mic. Is that a 3-0 proline? And you're like, what the heck? And he's coming and he's yelling at the surgeon doing the case to make sure he's using a 3-0 proline for his anastomosis. And it's just, they're watching.
So you've got the face of God from the anesthesiologist, right? Like hovering. Yeah. And then you've got the voice of God coming in from whatever speaker. You can get definitely, I think, hyper aware and super self-conscious at that point.
Like, oh, yeah.
With everything that you do. I don't know, when you look back at your time at Mayo and all of those experiences, is there anything that really you think back of? I want to hear both sides of it. So I want to hear, like, what's the fondest memory? And also what's the polar opposite of that?
Oh, man.
I know. I'm tough, man. I'm a tough interviewer.
that's tough, because the fond memories you tuck away and you try not to pull those out that often. I don't. I mean, they're there and I remember them once in a while and I think, oh man, there's times when you do cases and you walk out of there and you feel like you're bulletproof, or you're 10 feet tall, and you just, man, that guy never should have made it. And we did, we made it. We got him through, and that was a, it was a nightmare, but we did it. You have those moments here and there. I had enough of them that I can't really pin it on one to say, but I know that feeling. That's the feeling that, that makes you feel so fond about your profession, is when you know you're doing the job as best you can and the outcome is astronomically good, and it maybe shouldn't be. And then the opposite of that is what you're talking about, is when you do everything you can and you work yourself to where you're falling asleep in the corner in a bloody gown and it didn't work, right. You know, and that's the tough stuff. And those are the times you go home and you're like, what am I doing again? Why am I doing this?
Why am I here? How did you process those? I was a trauma scrub and did transplants. And just because of that subspecialty, we lost a lot of people. Yeah. Cardiovascular, it's the same. Yeah. You lose a lot more patients in those cases than I think we typically do. And what was your coping mechanism for that?
You know, we leaned on each other a lot. And I think that's a big key. No one's going to understand your therapeutic adventure that doesn't understand the situation you're in. So I think it's important to connect with your coworkers, and you develop some pretty close relationships. I mean, even though we don't talk all day and we're 25 feet apart from the folks in the next room, they're still doing the same thing you're doing, and they're going to have some of those same emotions. And it's important to clarify that with other people and to get through it, because there's going to be tomorrow. There's going to be another chance. And it's one of the things that when I drive to work every day, mm-hmm. and I tell my students when they're coming into the program, I said, if you would have told me 10 years ago that I'd be standing here in front of you as your program chair, I would have laughed at you. There's no way. I was living the dream, baby. I had the best job in the world, and I loved it. I tell them I'd go back and do it all over again in a heartbeat. Oh. Wouldn't even think twice about it. And my friend Ron, who actually got me started into it, we're still friends, and he's an administrator now. He had a strong past with CSTs. He was the president of the NBSTSA for a while. And we still talk. Every few months, he'll call me and say, when are you going to send me some more students? Because he's now an administrator in a hospital. But it's a very challenging career that way, to have to have therapy from what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But I think if you internalize everything, you're going to become bitter in this field. You have to let those bad emotions out, and I don't know, kindle them into something else, mm-hmm. so that they can be used for energy into being better. Actually, we have to always be learning in surgery, and sometimes we learn from bad things. Yeah. So
I say that all the time, actually, because growth happens in mistakes. Like, we don't grow through our successes. We grow when we're screwing up royally. And it takes a lot of courage to actually maybe have that self-reflection to say, yeah, man, I messed up. Like, I didn't do this right, or I should have done this better. And I think that the OR forces you to do that, whether you want to or not. How did you transition into teaching after such an adrenaline filled, like, you're used to go, 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 go. Our brains flip on and they actually work really well when somebody's trying to die. And then you have to go to a classroom and try to figure out how to slow down and explain the things that you do really fast in a methodical way. What was that transition like for you out of the OR?
Well, I can tell you the...
I wish our listeners could see the grimace that you just pulled
right in front of me. It's shock. I mean, because you suddenly, you're responsible. And I think about it, you know, I was working so many years as a preceptor and having new employees and students come through. And it's just very different when you're actually working on the academic side of it. It's challenging because now you have a lot of good experience behind you, and you have a lot of things, some stuff you maybe shouldn't be sharing, you know, as some of my defense mechanisms from surgeons behaving poorly probably aren't the best guide for other people. Right. You know, I might have been able to get away with it. Some folks maybe not so well. Yeah. But it's a tough career to be a surgical tech. because I tell the students all the time, you're going to hit every emotion that you can think of. And you might even find some new ones in the operating room. You know, when you mentioned right at the start of this episode, going to the dark side of academia, that's almost what it felt like when I started, because I was like, oh my God, I'm going to mess up. I just knew immediately I'm going to mess this up. And I hope they don't run me out the building. And I just gave every effort I could. I pulled from a lot of people. I had a really good program chair who didn't even start out as a surgical tech. She was a nurse and started the program that I now run. And she had to go back and get her CST the first year she was teaching students because she wanted to run a surgical tech program. I luckily had someone who freshly became a CST helping me along as an instructor, who kind of did the opposite way of me. And we connected really well, and she helped me. She said, there's times I had to throw you a lifeline, and thanks for grabbing it. And I was like, I had to grab it.
I think that there's, you know, you go from, I just had this discussion the other day, because you go from being the expert in the room. You know, this is not a G-rated podcast, but you go from being like, I am the badass in this situation. Like, you're the person they go to, because you have worked really hard to get there. And then you get into education where you feel like you're starting in kindergarten. You don't speak the same language. You have no idea what you're doing. And there are people with eyes on you, looking at you, expecting you to know what you're doing. And that's a hard transition to go from expert to new kid. It takes a lot of humility and patience and mentors. I'm so glad you had one. I did too. I love the Cindy mask, by the way.
And I think a lot of it's about commitment. This is the academic side of it is every bit as challenging in a different way. We have a lot of help nationally, which I think is really important. But I also encourage people to work on their local and regional side too. I've become friends with other instructors in my state and became close. We've traded equipment. We've done all kinds of fun things like that. And we're actually thinking about some combined workshops between our programs and things like that.
That'd be awesome. So
I think you have to really lean on people if you want to be successful as an instructor. Nobody goes out there and just does it on their own. If they do, I want to meet them. As maybe that's Traycraft.
Please don't do that to me. He's gonna get I love it. We can mess with Casey. We adore him. I think that's a great kind of summation, because as you started in the operating room, it was a team of people that you leaned on to learn, and you're doing the same thing on the other end as an educator. And if that's not full circle, my friend, I don't know what is.
Yeah, and I can tell you it's drastically different than from the program that I went through compared to the program that I run now.
Uh-huh.
There has been obvious involvement on many levels nationally to get these programs to be what they are today. And I think we're offering a lot more to people than I would have ever hoped for.
We're shoving it in 18 months. A lot of pressure, right? Almost as much as an open heart on bypass. Well, thank you so much for being so open to this and for sharing your experiences. And also thank you for what you do as an educator. You're definitely somebody that I lean on, and I'm grateful to know you.
Likewise. It is my pleasure. I really enjoyed it. It's fun to reminisce and think about those times in the past when you had those catecholamine addictions and things, and it's just different now when you're a teacher. You don't get that big rush.
The adrenaline response.
Elevator.
Not the same. Yeah, yeah. It totally is. Well, I really appreciate it. And I know I'll see you soon in good old Iowa.
You bet. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Scrub Life podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and share. We can be found on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at the Scrub Life podcast. Show notes for this episode, as well as past episodes, Our contact information and the virtual suggestion box can be found at our webpage, thescrublifepodcast.com. This has been Chris Blevins and Stephanie Austin with the Scrub Life Podcast. Until next time, be safe, support each other, and stay sterile.